shortly before midnight on September 11, 2001, roughly 15 hours after the tragic attack on the World Trade Center, 46-year-old Polish immigrant Henryk Siwiak was fatally shot on the streets of a Brooklyn neighborhood in New York City. A day forever etched in the minds of the American people for its unimaginable loss of human life, Henryk's murder would be the only non-terror-related homicide in New York City on September 11th. And for nearly 20 years, it has gone unsolved. How did devoted family man Henryk Siwiak end up dead on the streets of Brooklyn? Was it just a mugging gone wrong? Or was his murder somehow related to the day's shocking events? This is a small foreign fact check. In today's episode, we'll be looking into the case of Henryk Siwiak, the last homicide of 9/11. In September of 2001, Henryk Siwiak had lived in New York City for a little less than 1 year. Having moved from Krakow, Poland in October of 2000, when he was laid off from his job as an inspector for the Polish National Railroad. In the face of a 15% unemployment rate in Poland, Henryk immigrated to the United States in desperation to find work, leaving behind his children, Gabriella, 17, and Adam, 10 years old, and his wife of 20 years, Iwa, who he had known since childhood. When Henryk moved to the United States, Iwa still had work in Poland as a middle school biology teacher. In addition to wanting to provide his family with a better life, his oldest child, Gabriella, was set to enter college soon, and he knew that he would need a job immediately to keep up with tuition. Henryk would not be entirely alone in the Big Apple, however, as his sister, Lucina, was already living there. She had lived in New York City for 7 years, having moved to the United States when the health food store she ran in Poland went under. Henryk would rent an apartment near his sister in the heavily Polish area of Rockaway, Queens, and the siblings communicated and saw each other frequently. Henryk soon learned that surviving in the United States as a recent immigrant meant hard work, and Henryk reportedly worked every single day that he was in America, often working more than one job per day so he could afford to support himself and send any extra funds back home to his wife and kids. His constant search for gainful employment was made even more complicated by the fact that Henryk spoke little English. His sister told the media that what little English he did know, he had learned from watching American TV. He had enrolled in a program to learn English, but his life was taken before the class began. Henryk dreamed that one day his hard work would finally pay off, and he would be able to return to Poland to build a new house for his family. Despite the endless cycle of work, Henryk loved his new home in the United States and had no reservations about moving around the city at all hours of the night to make it to his various odd jobs. His sister told the media, quote, "We told him New York City was a dangerous place, but he didn't believe it. Perhaps because he liked living here so much." In the preceding months, Henryk had been mainly working construction, but had recently lost that job. There are conflicting reports surrounding the loss of this construction job. Some say that he had lost the job days before, while some articles say that the site had been shut down when the sky began to fill with smoke on the day of the attack. In either case, most sources agree that Henryk was downtown, not far from the World Trade Center that morning, either at the construction site or wandering the city looking for work. Henryk returned home that afternoon and phoned his wife to let her know he was okay. His family back home had been worried, having seen the attack on the local news. During their conversation, he recounted his story of witnessing the attack firsthand and told her how he saw the planes hit the buildings and that he could feel the rumble of the towers collapsing as he evacuated the area. Despite having been a witness to the attack, Henrik had been isolated from the media that day and did not immediately grasp the meaning and motive behind the attack, and was filled in on the phone by his wife, who had spent the last several hours glued to the coverage. Henrik was in no position to lose work for even one day, so after this conversation with his wife, he began searching the newspapers for opportunities. Henrik was relieved when he found a job that he could begin that very night, cleaning at a supermarket after it closed for $10 an hour. The ad ran in New York's Polish newspaper, the Super Express, and read, quote, "Men to clean stores in Brooklyn and Queens, English not necessary." Again, there are conflicting reports on how he obtained this job. Some reports say he actually found the position by visiting a Polish employment agency in person earlier that day. He called his wife again to update her about the good news about his new gig, but she was apprehensive given the day's events and did not want Henrik to go out that night. Iwa would later tell the media, quote, "I told him, just in case, don't leave tonight, because it can be dangerous in New York." However, due to the stresses of supporting himself and his family, he decided to take the job anyways. In the late evening hours of September 11, 2001, Henrik set out to meet with an employee of the cleaning agency on Albany Street, where they would then head to a nearby Pathmark supermarket to begin their evening of cleaning. Henrik had never met this employee before, so to make sure that the man would recognize Henrik, he told him that he would be wearing his favorite outfit, camo pants and a matching army coat that he had purchased at the Salvation Army, along with some black boots. That night, Henrik set off on foot after borrowing a subway map from his landlady and asking for directions to the supermarket. They had looked at the subway map together and charted a path for Henrik to take to his new job. According to Henrik's wife, the landlady also tried to convince Henrik not to go out that evening. Iwa tells the media later, quote, "It later turned out he was supposed to go late at night to a neighborhood that he didn't know at all. He borrowed a map from his landlady. I spoke to her later. She tried to stop him, told him it wasn't a good neighborhood. It was not a good time to go there, and definitely not on that particular day." As promised, Henrik dressed in his favorite camo outfit to be recognizable to his new coworker. His military-style look definitely made him stand out, and witnesses later remembered seeing the man in camo at various points along his journey. Henrik took the A train from his home in Queens and got off at Nostrand Avenue, as he had planned with his landlady. As it turned out, the course they had plotted together actually led off roughly 3 miles away from where he thought he was getting off, forcing Henrik to trek the remaining 3 miles to the store on foot. Henrik soon became lost and ended up in the Bed-Stuy neighborhood of Brooklyn, a known area for drugs, assaults, and robberies. A longtime resident told the media that the neighborhood could be safe in the morning, but after that, you were on your own. Despite the traumatic events of the day that had unfolded mere miles away, illicit activity in Bed-Stuy didn't seem to skip a beat. Detective Michael Prate, a detective assigned to the case, told the New York Times, quote, "I don't know if the World Trade Center falling down affects the drug trade on Albany Avenue." Around 11:45 p.m., neighbors around Albany Avenue heard shots ring out. Many residents who heard the shots took cover and were afraid to look out of their windows. When they finally did, they found Henrik Siwiak collapsed face first on the walkway leading away from a residence, surrounded by a pool of his own blood. A trail of blood showed that Henrik had dragged himself to the front entrance of 119 Decatur Street, where he tried to seek help, but no one answered the door. A resident inside the building would tell the New York Times later, quote, "I heard the bell ringing, but I wasn't answering it after I heard those shots." Henrik attempted to backtrack to find help elsewhere, but collapsed after making it only a few paces away from the first door that he had tried. On any other night, an entire team of detectives and a team from New York City's crime scene unit would have been dispatched to comb the scene for any shred of evidence that might help them solve the case, and canvass the neighborhood for any witnesses. However, in the chaos of the day's events, first responders were tied up at Ground Zero, searching the rubble for survivors. Detective Prate told the media, quote, "He wasn't afforded the initial experts in processing the homicide scene. It was old school. If it wasn't 9/11, you would have had 8 or 9 detectives out here canvassing the scene. That night, you might have had 2 or 3. Detective Robert Boyce, who at the time was the commanding officer of the 40th Precinct in the Bronx, would explain to ABC News, quote, "Normally when we have a homicide, we will incorporate everybody in the NYPD, all different units to help solve it. If we don't have a witness or don't have any kind of direction on it, or any kind of motive early on, which we didn't in this homicide, we would take the narcotics division, we would take the gang division, we would take the vice division, whatever we could, to go into that area and see if they can find some kind of witness that would tell us exactly what happened or what they were hearing. Because of 9/11, we couldn't do that. We were sending resources down to Lower Manhattan. Complete uncertainty we were operating in that day and the days after. We didn't know who survived. We didn't know how many people died. We were operating really just flying by the seat of our pants. This is something I don't think I've ever experienced prior to or after." He continues, "I didn't get a day off for the next 4 months. Nobody did. And we worked 12-hour days. You can't imagine the stress, the fatigue that we were going through, as well as the unknown, because everybody was waiting for the next shoe to drop. We were getting bomb scares all the time. Resources were stretched. You really had to draw upon your own resources to solve your problems in each area of the city." When officers did arrive to the site of Henrik's murder, they began processing the scene. They recovered 7 shell casings at the scene, but only one matched the .40-caliber handgun that had been used to kill Henrik. Investigators immediately questioned if Henrik had been the victim of a mugging, but that theory seemed to lose credence when $75 in cash was found untouched in Henrik's wallet. Henrik also was reported to have been carrying a bag that night, but no reports indicate it was missing or stolen, leading me to assume that the bag was found with Henrik. The investigation into Henrik's slaying quickly went cold. There were no witnesses to the actual shooting, but a few residents reported that they had seen Henrik walking in the neighborhood in his camo outfit shortly before the crime, and that it looked like he was being followed from a few hundred feet back by a group of 2 or 3 men. The current lead detective on the case, Detective George Harvey, told Inside Edition about the case, quote, "It was something that was pushed aside. We really didn't receive a lot of help from the public in regards to this case. Back in 2001, there was no iPhones, there was no video cameras. There was a few, but not like there is today in the neighborhood. Every building around here pretty much has a camera on it. It makes it easier to solve some of the crimes. But back then, 2001, we just relied on the public to come forward and give us information." The case received almost no media coverage in the days following Henrik's murder, as the world's news organizations were all occupied covering the terrorist attack. Only one major newspaper wrote about the murder initially, but it wasn't until 3 weeks later. And one Polish newspaper covered the murders, but it wasn't until after Lucina contacted them personally. They'd been busy focusing on the death of 5 Poles in the World Trade Center. Almost 20 years have passed, and detectives are no closer to solving the murder of Henrik Siwiak. However, a few theories about how his tragic death occurred have been offered by law enforcement, loved ones, and online sleuths. Detectives who have worked on the case have publicly stated their prime theory, that Henrik was the victim of a robbery gone wrong. Witnesses did report seeing a small gang of men following Henrik from a distance shortly before the shooting. Law enforcement believes that these men moved in on Henrik and demanded his money, but that Henrik's lack of understanding of English led to some sort of miscommunication and escalated to Henrik's murder instead of just a simple mugging. If this is the case, the suspects fled immediately instead of searching for any valuables on the man, as his wallet, still containing $75 in cash, was found with him. The biggest thing that makes me think that this may not be the real story is the fact that Henrik was carrying a bag that night, In no reports that I read made any mention of the bag having been taken or that it was missing from the scene. If your motivation is to rob someone, I can understand not wanting to pick their pockets, but a bag seems like a much easier item to take from someone who has just been mortally wounded, so why leave the bag behind? Henrik's loved ones and online sleuths both aren't convinced that the crime was just a simple robbery, and many of their theories revolve around Henrik's choice of attire that night, his military camouflage-style coat and pants, and black boots. The outfit definitely stood out, and several individuals who saw Henrik that night wondered what his story was, and what a man in military fatigues was doing wandering around a bad neighborhood near midnight on the eve of 9/11. After the murder, when police arrived on scene, even investigators didn't know what to make of the outfit, and at least one officer theorized that he might have been a member of the National Guard who had come down to help at Ground Zero before they discovered Henrik's real identity. Thousands of first responders from all over the country did in fact travel to assist with the recovery efforts in the hours, days, and weeks following the attacks, and by midnight on the first night, hundreds, if not thousands, had already arrived in town. This fact has led online commenters to speculate if maybe one of these first responders from outside of New York City was responsible for the murder. The area where Henrik was murdered was only about 4 miles away from Ground Zero. Did a visiting police officer see Henrik in his fatigues, carrying a bag in the general vicinities of where the towers had been, and decided he looked suspicious and tried to stop him? This theory, like the previous theory, supposes that Henrik's poor English language skills may have made him appear uncooperative and hostile to a non-local police officer who was out of their element in the big city, possibly coming from an area with less diversity, and who was still reeling and worked up from the day's events, and that some kind of misunderstanding may have escalated to Henrik's murder. This person would have feared punishment for their crimes, and knew they would not have had the same protections as an on-duty officer, and that there would be no way to justify their actions, and so they decided to flee the scene. Law enforcement has confirmed that the type of gun used to kill Henrik, a .40 caliber handgun, is not consistent with the type of gun carried specifically by New York City police officers. Throughout the years, Henrik's sister Lucina hasn't been able to shake the idea that Henrik's death was directly related to the terror attack that day. 9/11 was a traumatic day for every American, and while many were still grappling to understand what had occurred and were beginning to deal with the grief of a nation, there were also those whose anger had already shifted to thoughts of revenge. Lucina tells the media that Henrik did not look like a typical Polish person. He had a much darker olive complexion, salt and pepper dark hair, thick dark eyebrows, and a perpetual 5 o'clock shadow, which makes Lucina believe that Henrik was probably mistaken for someone of Middle Eastern descent that night by someone looking to get revenge or become a hero by thwarting another attack. With his militaristic outfit, not immediately recognizable foreign accent, and the late night hours he was keeping that night, Henrik would have fit the description of what these restless vigilantes might have been patrolling the streets looking for. Lucina told the Associated Press of her theory, quote, "I think maybe it was a mistake. There were many angry people." It has been almost 20 years since Henrik Ziwiak was slain on the streets of Brooklyn. After his murder, Henrik's remains were returned to his family in his native Poland. Lucina told the media, quote, "He really liked New York, but I think he would have wanted to be buried in Poland." Henrik is remembered as a devoted family man who gave his life in the pursuit of providing a better life for his wife and children. His wife, Iwa, was devastated by the senseless murder of her husband of 20 years and described herself as an emotional wreck following his death. She told the media through a translator, quote, "He was a loving husband and a loving father. He loved making us happy. He loved teaching his son to ride his bike or play chess, loved helping me around the house. We were leading a modest but dignified life. In the shadow of the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, Henrik Siwiak's murder is relegated to being just a footnote to history as the only non-terrorism-related murder in New York City that day. Over 2,600 people were murdered in New York City on September 11, 2001, but Henrik Siwiak is the only one whose case remains unsolved. Even though many years have passed, the NYPD remain hopeful that this is a case that can be solved. Detective Harvey told the media, quote, "We'd like to ultimately give the family some kind of closure in regards to the case and find out who did this. Around the anniversary, we also hang up the reward posters, hoping to generate new information in regards to the case. We believe someone saw something. It's just a matter of finding that person. I believe Albany Avenue is a pretty tight-knit block, so I believe that probably the person responsible is probably still in the area." The NYPD is offering a reward of $10,000, and Crime Stoppers will pay an additional $2,000 for the information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible for the murder of Henrik Siwiak. Anyone with information is asked to call Crime Stoppers at 1-800-577-TIPS. Callers should refer to the Crime Stoppers poster number BK1375 when calling. All calls will be kept confidential. Before we go, I wanted to revisit a case that I covered a few episodes ago, the murder of Dwayne Jones, a gender nonconforming 16-year-old Jamaican teen that was murdered by a mob after they attended a quote-unquote straight party dressed in women's clothing. The case generated a lot of comments from listeners, and for good reason. It was a shocking and vile act of mob violence, made even more horrifying by the cultural and legislative elements of Jamaican society that made this case possible. However, there was one comment that kept coming up over and over again that I wanted to address. I got this comment from all different kinds of people. I heard it from lowly Reddit trolls, casual commenters, and from people that I know relatively well, who overall are tolerant people who support equal rights and justice. And that question is, what was Dwayne thinking? Why would Dwayne put themselves in a dangerous situation, knowing the threat they faced by entering a space in which they were not welcome? On its face, it's an understandable question. I think many people who heard the episode wish they could go back in time and stop Dwayne from attending that party. What happened to Dwayne was horrific, but perhaps not unpredictable given the history of open hostility and mob violence against the LGBTQ community in Jamaica. Why did Dwayne put themselves in harm's way? Why couldn't Dwayne have just been happy to stay with their own kind and live in the shadows of society, but in safety? If you heard that episode and had those questions, I don't blame you. If Dwayne had made different choices that night, they might still be alive today. But we must also recognize that these questions are victim blaming, plain and simple. The conversation should not be, why did Dwayne, a 16-year-old, make choices that led to their murder? The conversation should be, how could this atrocious crime occur, and how do the cultural, religious, and political institutions of Jamaica create an environment where literal mobs can torture and murder members of the LGBTQ community for the simple crime of being themselves, and then get away with it with no investigation? The question should be, how do we create a more tolerant world where people aren't raised to believe that it is actually righteous to exterminate people that have different lifestyles than you, and we should ask what needs to be done to transform countries affected by severe homophobia and transphobia into safe places for the LGBTQ community? Let me say it again. Dwayne was 16 years old. When I was 16 years old, I put myself into several situations that could have been very dangerous for me, and I think many of you can relate. Partying with older boys, taking scenic drives at night into the middle of nowhere with older guys that I barely knew, staying the night with strangers, you name it. If something had happened to me, a white, relatively gender-conforming female, do you think the conversation would be centered on why I went to that party, or why I went alone with that boy, or would people be saying, she was just 16, she didn't know any better, and rally for justice? And if that's the case, why don't we extend the same understanding and forgiveness to Dwayne? So even though it is victim blaming, let's take a closer look at that question. Why did Dwayne go to the party that night? Many LGBTQ individuals in Jamaica, like Dwayne, are forced out of their homes by intolerant family members, and with no protections in the property or job markets, are often relegated to living their lives in the literal sewers or in derelict neighborhoods where no other Jamaicans would live. What do you do in that scenario? Do you just accept being a pariah with no future? Do you retreat into the closet to live a lie in the interest of trying to lead a productive life in society? Or do you refuse to live in fear and isolation and attempt to live as your true self in society, risking your life to try to find peace and acceptance within yourself? I don't know what the right answer is, because I can't fathom being in such a dire situation. What I do know is that there is no justification ever for murdering a person of the LGBTQ community for living life as their true selves. We all need to fight for a world where teenage white girls and black, gender non-conforming Jamaican teens, and literally everyone in between, can make the kind of bad choices that 16-year-olds make, but still return home safe at the end of the night because no one has the right or is justified in perpetrating violence against another person. It's just that simple. And I bring this up because I want you all to be aware of the subtle ways that even well-meaning people may unknowingly victim blame in these kinds of cases, and how you can help redirect the conversation to the more meaningful topics of blind justice and equality, and challenge those who seek to discredit victims of vulnerable populations and defend the institutions that marginalize them. This has been a Small Foreign Fact Check, hosted by Jill Gogan. Thank you for joining me for this episode. As always, you'll be able to find a list of citations for the sources used in this episode in the show notes. You can follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at smallforeignfc, and you can reach the show at smallforeignfc@gmail.com. The show is released on all major podcast platforms and on YouTube as time permits. I've also got a merch store with some buttons and stickers, which is under the name Small Foreign FC on Etsy. There's a link for that in the show notes as well. If you enjoyed the show, it would be awesome if you left a 5-star review on Apple Podcast or Podchaser. That's always awesome, and I appreciate that. Thank you again for tuning in, and I'll talk to you all next week.